Welcome to the February podcast for the Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. I'm Josie Briggs, editor-in-chief of the journal. My guest today is Brendan Nguyen. Dr. Nguyen is an academic nephrology registrar at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney and an NHMRC postgraduate scholar at the George Institute in Australia. Dr. Nguyen was an editorial fellow with Jason from 2019 to 2020. So, Brendan, thank you for joining us in this conversation from Australia.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks very much for the opportunity, Josie.
Well, you're welcome. Our topic today is a manuscript that you must be proud of. It's a meta-analysis entitled Acute Treatment Effects on GFR in Randomized Clinical Trials of Kidney Disease Progression. It's from the CKD EPI Clinical Trials Consortium, and you are the first author. So give me some background. What led to this study?
So Josie, as you know, one of the major challenges in conducting randomized trials in nephrology is that kidney failure typically takes years to develop, and therefore one needs large numbers or very long follow-up to detect treatment effects on this outcome. So over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of work to identify, assess and refine alternative endpoints or surrogate outcomes to improve trial efficiency. And one of those most promising alternative endpoints is GFR slope. That's the annual rate of decline in GFR. And that's because it's been shown to be strongly associated with kidney failure and that treatment effects on GFR slope seem to predict treatment effects on clinical outcomes like kidney failure requiring dialysis. However, when interpreting treatment effects on GFR slope, it can be complicated if the treatment effect has an acute effect on GFR that differs from its long-term effect. These acute effects on GFR are really common, for example, with ACE inhibitors or ARBs or SGLT2 inhibitors, but their impact on clinical trial design has not been well understood. And so we conducted this meta-analysis of 53 studies enrolling almost 56,000 participants to better understand the magnitude and consistency of acute effects on GFR across a range of different levels of kidney function, albuminuria, disease states, and of course, interventions.
Right. Such an important question. In many of these trials, you were able to actually do an individual participant meta-analysis. Help our listeners understand what that means and why this was particularly valuable in this setting.
Yeah, so just very briefly, meta-analyses can be done two ways, using aggregate data or, secondly, using individual participant data. The first way is one in which many listeners would be familiar with, and that's to use published results from each of the trials and pull these to obtain a summary treatment effect. The second approach is slightly more onerous, and that's to obtain individual participant data from each of the individual trials and use a single statistical analysis that estimates the average treatment effect across the trials, taking into account covariates that are trial specific. Now, in this meta-analysis, we had access to the individual participant data from all 53 studies. And what that really did was it allowed us to standardize the analytical approach and outcomes across all of the trials. This was technically a hybrid of both approaches. We leveraged the individual participant data to standardize the analysis and outcomes and then pulled trial level estimates. But in essence, what it did was it gave us a much greater ability to assess the impact of things like baseline GFR, albuminuria, and disease state and how that might affect the acute effect. So it was a really important way to answer this question.
Right. You know, in order to get individual participant level analyses, you require heavily willingness to data share. The CKD EPI Clinical Trials Consortium Group has worked hard over many years to develop the understandings that have facilitated this level of data sharing. But many of us who are thinking about these issues are pushing for greater, stronger data sharing standards that will make that much easier. Any comments on the data sharing challenges?
Yeah, it's a really complex issue, and I'd like to pay tribute to the CKD EPI leadership. particularly Professor Leslie Inke and Professor Hiddo-Hiersbink, who've done a fantastic job leading the consortium and who continue to work through many of these complex issues. In the CKD EPI consortium, included trials have been identified through systematic searches that are repeated at regular intervals, with the ongoing goal of including additional randomized trials on a rolling basis as they become available. Now, studies can be acquired through a number of different mechanisms, for example, sharing by academic institutions or sharing by sponsors, or even from public sharing platforms. And I think data sharing as a principle is important for a number of reasons. Firstly, funders are increasingly mandating data sharing, for example, the NIH, the Wellcome Trust, and the Gates Foundation, just to name a few. Secondly, many top journals are increasingly requesting that data sharing statements are made at the time of publication. And finally, there is, of course, the moral imperative to do so, to maximize scientific knowledge from trials and other studies. At the same time, it's important to ensure balance so that investigators are able to report their findings from trials and that data are best used to address the most important questions to health. And there are also challenges in terms of propriety and privacy regulations, which in some jurisdictions can make data sharing quite cumbersome. So whilst there are a number of important benefits, there are many factors, often quite complex, to work through in addressing this.
Yes, it's a really important topic. Certainly at our journal, we are trying to set high expectations while at the same time make sure that all the appropriate cautions are exercised. Okay, so what are the most critical findings from your analysis and how will they help us in future trials?
So, Josie, we made three main findings. Firstly, we found that negative acute effects on GFR were observed in most trials of renin-angiotensin system blockade, intensive blood pressure lowering in SGLT2 inhibitor trials, while positive acute effects were observed more commonly in trials of immunosuppressive agents. Secondly, we found that negative acute effects appeared to be larger at higher baseline GFR. And finally, even within interventions, and particularly at an individual level, there is substantial variability in the magnitude of the observed acute effects. And what these findings taken together demonstrate is the importance of understanding the nature and magnitude of acute effects for each specific intervention quite early in the trial life cycle stage to inform the design and analysis of longer term studies. And understanding that acute effect is really important in deciding whether or not to use GFR slope or a clinical outcome like doubling of serum creatinine. Many ongoing trials are using slope-based endpoints. For example, many of the endothelin receptor antagonist trials in glomerular diseases and finerenone in non-diabetic kidney disease, and factoring in that acute effect in statistical power calculations and analysis plans is absolutely crucial.
Right. The variability at an individual level is, of course, striking. I wish we could show listeners the excellent summary graph that's part of your visual abstract. I hope our listeners will look at our website to see that. One thing that certainly surprised me was the magnitude of the difference seen with the immunotherapies, with indeed a positive initial slope. Do you have any comment on that? Were you surprised by that? And what do you think we are learning from that?
Yeah, I mean, these results are really high-level overview of the different trials. And certainly there is a lot of variability in the immunosuppressive agents because these trials tend to be smaller, and so there's a greater degree of variability. But also this category of immunosuppressive therapies encompasses a range of different interventions that have different effects. For example, CNIs might have different acute effects on GFR to corticosteroids or other immunotherapies. So there is a lot to be gained from looking at individual trials as well as overall results, like we've done here.
Right. Your graph shows narrow bell-shaped curves for RAS blockade and SGLT inhibitors, and then a wide variability moving to the right for the immunosuppressive therapies. It's a striking graph. So let me ask you one. Yeah, go ahead.
And another comment. And another comment, Josie, just to build on that, is the comparator in the trials often is quite variable. In many of those immunosuppressive trials, they might have been against a placebo arm or an active treatment, and so that can also influence the magnitude of the acute GFR effect, because of course the acute effect is the difference between the active and control arm.
Right. Okay. So, to just raise one other question, your studies were primarily undertaken with the goal to contribute to clinical trial design, but they are, of course, of some relevance to clinical decision-making as well. So how can we approach moving from these observations to the kind of answers patients and clinicians want when they see an EGFR decline when they start one of these agents?
Yes, well, you're right that this analysis was primarily undertaken to understand the impacts of acute GFR effects on clinical trial design, but it also gives us some insights into clinical care as well. We know that analyses from existing completed trials have yielded some answers. For example, in the Credence trial and in other SGLT2 inhibitor trials, there have been analyses assessing the effects on kidney outcomes as well as adverse events stratified by the magnitude of the acute GFR change. And what these analyses demonstrated in general was that the benefits are similar regardless of the magnitude of the acute GFR dip, and that safety is generally similar. In these trials, GFR drops of greater than 30% occurred rarely. In those cases, were associated with potential harms. Now, there are some limitations to these analyses as they're not randomized. One other way to assess the impact on clinical outcomes is to look at trials where there is an active run-in period, because then it's possible to do randomized comparisons according to the magnitude of the GFR change during the run-in period before randomization. A very good example of that is the ADVANCE trial, which randomized people to perindopril and indapamide. And what that demonstrated was similar benefits and harms that were no different regardless of the magnitude of the acute GFR change. So I think applying these kinds of statistical approaches to new as well as established therapies is important and can enhance our understanding of how the acute GFR effect can impact on patient care, particularly in people with chronic kidney disease.
Right. Okay. Very important. One quick question. I know your work used the 2009 CKD epi equation. As you know, we are moving to a new race-free equation. Do you think it would make any difference if you used the new equation?
Yeah, I mean, the work on the CKD epi race-free equations is clearly important. It has many potential implications. I think how this affects all aspects of nephrology remains to be seen. In the Credence trial, for example, there was an analysis done recently looking at treatment effects on GFR using the new race-free equation, and that demonstrated that the treatment effects were generally not really changed with the new equation, reassuringly. In terms of acute effects on GFR in clinical trials and treatment effects more generally, it's my personal view that it's unlikely that these findings will substantively change with the new equations, but certainly more work should be done in this area.
Yeah, that in general, we are seeing a number of papers that look at this question, and most of the time, the changing equations, unless you have a very specific population, doesn't seem to change results very much. So just to briefly, in our last few minutes, to change the topic, I wonder if you could tell the listeners briefly about your experience as an editorial fellow at JASN. What did you do and what did you take away from the experience?
Yeah, I spent almost 2 years working as an editorial fellow at JASN with Professor Vlado Perkovic. And this was really outstanding training and hugely informative to my development as a clinician scientist. Gave me the opportunity to read and evaluate the latest science. And that has really informed my own approach. It was a real privilege to work with so many inspiring people who care so deeply about advancing kidney health. And it really was a great responsibility in many ways to ensure that the best science was being communicated as effectively as possible. And you really feel that on the other side as part of the editorial board, trying to make sure that the questions answered as rigorously as possible so that we can improve the health of patients with kidney disease. It was a fantastic experience and I'd really recommend it to anyone who's considering applying.
Well, you did a great job. We very much enjoyed your participation. So what's next for you? What are you working on now? I saw in a Twitter comment that you're interested in implementation science. What are you thinking about?
Yeah, well, I'm continuing to work with Professor Hiers Bink and Leslie Inker on the CKD Epi Consortium. I'm working on a number of trials, including SGLT2 inhibitors in newly diagnosed diabetes, finerenone in non-diabetic kidney disease. But one area that is particularly of interest to me at the moment is how we can advance this concept of implementation science in nephrology. And the reason I'm thinking about that more and more at the moment is that the therapeutic pipeline in CKD is more promising than ever. We've got several new treatments now to slow CKD progression and cardiovascular events. But the challenge is, how can we ensure that these findings from trials actually translate to routine practice to improve outcomes? And there are so many questions that need to be answered in or addressed in this regard. What's the so-called treatment gap between what we know works and how often it's implemented? And how does that differ across different settings? What would the impact be on healthcare if we optimally implement what we know works in trials into practice? And how can we bring rigorous scientific methods to improve the uptake of proven therapies and importantly, ensure health equity? So these are all questions that I think that we as a community should start thinking about over the next 5-10 years and hopefully improve or translate what we know from trials into real life practice as quickly as possible.
Well, I'm sure you'll make a terrific contribution. As I think you know, at the journal, we're thinking a lot about the health inequity problems. Not only is the magnitude of chronic kidney disease very important for the health of many people, but it's the care we are delivering is remarkably unequal. And that is one of the reasons we need the implementation research is how to bridge those gaps. So, Brendan, thank you for your terrific work as a fellow and for a terrific paper. I really enjoyed this conversation and look forward to seeing the next stages in your career, which I'm sure will be quite terrific.
This podcast is copyrighted by the American Society of Nephrology. All rights reserved. All content in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be medical advice. This podcast should not be used in a medical emergency or for the diagnosis or treatment of any medical condition. Please consult your doctor or other qualified healthcare provider if you have any questions about any medical condition or before taking any drug, changing your diet, or commencing or discontinuing any course of treatment. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the American Society of Nephrology.